We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.
Want to put your baseball skills to the test? Then get ready to show your stuff with MLB Pitch, Hit, and Run. The official youth skills competition of Major League Baseball. Sign up for free for a chance to play your way to the Pitch, Hit, and Run finals at the 2024 World Series. Visit pitchhitrun.com today.
GNR, welcome to the jungle. 42 degrees in Kansas City. And it is, I was just thinking about that song and that album. Man, you talk about game changers. The first time I heard Guns N' Roses, Appetite for Destruction, was a goddamn game changer. Van Halen, game changer. And Anthrax, same way, man. You there are moments in your life you can remember what the album looked like, what it felt like with the liner notes, how the way they were printed, and it just leaves an indelible mark on your life if you're a real music nerd. Like, and that's what I was. I mean, just didn't have a lot of friends, didn't play sports. Well, particularly great in school. I liked books because you could disappear into them. And then you discovered music, and that ran along with girls. So everything went its way. And Scott Ian was a huge part of that.
Born December 31st in Queens, New York. In 1981, he founded a band that would become known alongside such bands as Metallica, Slayer, and Megadeth as one of the founding fathers of thrash metal. That band is Anthrax.
The band prepares to celebrate their 40th anniversary this July. They're posting video testimonials, band history, and much more on their website, Anthrax.com. Please welcome longtime friend of the show, Anthrax co-founder and guitarist, Scott Ian.
Scott Ian, how are you, Scott?
Hey, how's it going, man?
Good, but I was just talking to these guys about albums that changed it for you, and, you know, Spreading the Disease and Among the Living were life changers, GNR's Appetite, Van Halen, the first record I ever owned, just albums that completely changed life for you.
Oh, they definitely changed my life.
Yeah.
You talk those two specifically, but if you're talking about bands that are not my band for me,
yeah,
I mean, God, you know, first, obviously, for me, The biggest one would be Kiss Alive.
Sure, absolutely. A Kiss Alive, and here's the thing that was so good about Kiss Alive for me. I heard that record before I heard some of the albums that they were from, and I loved the live versions even more than the recorded versions.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Yeah, and I, to this day, that's the only album I can think of that I go, wow, isn't it strange? I genuinely, without a doubt, prefer the live version of this song. And it's just a rare, rare occurrence. By the way, congratulations, 40 years of Anthrax. It's who would have ever believed at the beginning of this in New York City in the hardcore scene that it would go 40 years?
Yeah, it's even, I mean, obviously I've had a lot of, I keep saying obviously, it's only obvious to me, but I've had a lot of time over the last few months to think about it as we started planning, well, how are we going to celebrate 40 years? And there's still no way for me to really put it into a context that I understand or that makes any sense really to me. You know, look, it's simple on paper. It's like, yeah, the band started in 1981, and I could go through the last 40 years and, you know, give you all the, I could give you the kind of the bullet points for 40 years, or I could break it down into the minutiae of, you know, what we were doing on a daily basis. It's just crazy that 40 years have passed. I mean, to think about it in those terms, that you know, I'm 57, and I've been doing this for 40 years. That's more than two-thirds, right?
Of course.
My time on this planet. It's pretty crazy. I don't know that there's many active bands, you know, that are at the same. I mean, obviously Metallica, because they're the same year as us. They're also going to sell. Their 40th is this year. And then, of course, you've got the bands that came before us that are still, whether it's Priest and Maiden or, you know, obviously the Stones and U2, AC/DC. But still, the list, it thins out pretty quick.
Well, and think about it. When you say your name around those others, aren't you still like, God, how did it, like, because it's just, I think guys like you are always getting better and always finding new things because you don't self-congratulate too much. You tend to look forward, not so much in the past. And when you do look in the past, you're like, I can't believe it, man. This is pretty great. This is, you know, you still seem genuinely happy with success and with what it affords you in playing on that stage.
Yeah. I love this. I heard something recently, because I've always attributed the longevity of the band, the success of the band, to a couple of things. Of course, the main thing being the connection that we've made with people, with the fans all over the planet. That obviously, without them, there's no band for 40 years. But the connection that we've made has been strong enough. Going from people that became fans in the 80s, or if you just became a fan 2 months ago, you know, that's one of the main reasons why we're still here is because of the fans. Another thing is our drive and our love for what we do and that passion. And I kind of always attributed that to, well, I've got a really good work ethic, and, you know, I look at it as this is my job. I get up every day and I do my job in this band as Anthrax, and I move the business forward every day in some way, shape, or form, and that's always been my goal. And I've always come back to this idea of my work ethic and my discipline and my focus and all that, and all of that is true. But I heard something recently in an interview with Jerry Seinfeld where he said, yes, that all of that makes sense, but the way he put it really kind of turned me on my head, because I had never thought of it this way. But he said, when you have a career and you're doing something that you love and you've got this long-term career, when you truly love what you do and you're truly passionate about it, you have an endless well of energy to be able to draw from.
Yeah.
It will never be depleted. And when he said that, it made such sense to me. And he said, and everything else, your focus and your work ethic and your determination, those are like the captains on the battlefield. And they follow, you know, they follow the general, which is your love.
Yeah.
That endless well of energy. They follow that out there every day to get the job done. But it really is, if you truly love something, then you'll never be tired of doing it.
No doubt about it, man. Creating stuff, what greater joy it is. And you've got, it's great, because like reading your book, you talk about that work ethic just now, and it's what saved you as a kid. It's what got you out of the house. You know, your mom is wearing you out. She's really over the top, and you know, you're working any job you can have from a young age. It gives you money, which gives you ability to do what you want to do, and you hold your grades together. But that work ethic is what drove you to this in the very beginning, and it's what saved you in the beginning, I think.
Yeah, for sure.
It
definitely gave me not a distraction, but something that I truly wanted to be a part of and truly wanted to focus on. And that, you know, and it did, yeah. It got me out of the house, even when I was in the house. I think I say it in the book, or my mom might say it, because she used to see me just sitting on the couch. The TV wouldn't even be, I'd just be sitting on the couch, staring off into space. And she would, like, get on my case. She'd be like, what are you doing? Get off your ass, go out, get a job, you know, do something. What are you doing sitting there? And I'm thinking about my music. thinking about songs. And that's what I was doing. I would just sit there and you know, go into my brain and think about music. And she never understood that, obviously, until years later.
Yeah, right. Yeah. It's just, when I read this book, there's so many parallels with so many of my friends, with myself, with our lives, with, you know, kids who just went into music. They weren't exceptional with women. They weren't necessarily athletes. You know, they tend to go towards more individual things like skating or bikes. And I just go, man, you know, at the time in the 80s, you didn't know there were other kids like you if they didn't live in your neighborhood. And then you met another kid based on their patch on their jacket or their T-shirt. And you were like, ah, Metallica, Anthrax, I see, Maiden, Priest, Sabbath, Ozzy. You know, it goes on and on, ZZ Top, AC/DC. But you knew all of a sudden you had your member of your tribe. And that's how you survived childhood.
Yeah, 100%. That's my junior high and high school experience,
yeah.
Right there, is you see somebody wearing a band T-shirt that you like, and you make a beeline to that person and strike up a conversation, because, you know, even at that time, I grew up in Queens, you know, in New York City, and we were still very much the minority. You know, I was in a high school of 3,000 kids, and I would say us rock guys, or us, you know, people would call us rockheads, or just whatever names they could come up for us long-haired leather jacket guys. There was, at the most, there was 10 of us, maybe with a couple of, you know, hangers-on guys that didn't maybe wear leather jackets and didn't have a Judas Priest T-shirt, but they kind of hanging out on the periphery with us, but it's not like we were tough or anything like that. We had a table in the lunchroom as far away from everyone else as we possibly could
sure.
be, and a little boombox that my friend David would bring in every day, and we'd bring cassettes, and, you know, we'd listen to music during lunch and sit there and talk about who's the best lead guitar player that day. You know, and of course, until Eddie, it was always Ritchie Blackmore, and then, you know, Eddie showed up in 1978, and then that question was never asked again.
Oh, dude. And you would get into violent. Like, I remember I would never argue politics. I didn't care about politics, but I'd be 16, 17, 18 years old. And I mean, I would be red in the face arguing somebody a point on music, a point good or bad, who was better, what was more important, why that sucked, why it didn't suck.
Oh, dude, we used to make polls. Like, literally, we would, on blank pieces of paper, you'd grab some paper from a classroom, and we'd make these grids, and you'd make a list of, like, 30 lead guitar players on one, and then on another sheet, all the lead singers, and then all the drummers, and so on. And then you'd we'd make these grids with boxes, and then you'd go around to everyone you knew who would slightly even give a crap about this, and then they would rate each guy from 1 to 10. And then at the end of the day, after everyone would collect, all of us, we would all have these sheets, we would copy them, and we'd go around all our friends, and then at the end of the day, we'd tally up, you know, all the ratings.
That's so great.
Who is the best singer? Who is the best guitar player? This is what we would do. This is how I spent my high school years.
Yeah, because it wasn't getting laid like the cool kids, you know? I mean, all of us were, that's what we did. And when I read about, like, the jealousy in my heart over the time in New York City, you know, CBGB's was still open. They were doing some hardcore shows. You were it was the punk rock New York scene, the counterpart to England and London, and it was unlike anything else in the United States. And to me, the East Coast has always had that draw. So then Johnny Z and Rock and Roll Heaven and the record stores, and I mean, I still travel back to New York City to go down to Record Store Day and on Bleecker and wander about and just go buy stuff because I want to see if I can get that feeling somehow. And you know, that's that's where you were growing up. That's how you met the guys in Metallica. I mean, all of that time, what a magical time in music.
Yeah, I mean, it really was. You don't really know it so much when you're in it because,
yeah,
like for us, like especially, let's say starting, once the band started in 81, it was just the daily grind of what do we do, how do we do it, how do we get anyone to take notice of us? What do we do? What do we do? What do we do? There is no playbook. Obviously, there is no internet. It was just a case of getting out there. That was that was to us the only way to do it. So we already went to record stores already all the time, you know, Danny and I, Wilker. We already were going to shows all the time since we started hanging out around 79 or something. So it was just kind of, you know, an extension of what we were already doing. But now we had a band, and then we would go in a room and bang out like a demo. And then you'd go to the record store, and you'd go to shows, and you'd hand out your demos.
Yeah.
And you'd make flyers for a gig that you had coming up, and you'd hand out your flyers. And, I mean, that's what we did. We just got out there and showed our faces and just tried to expose as many people, ironically, to Anthrax as we possibly
yeah.
as we possibly could. But yeah, and that's how we met Johnny Z. Johnny, for those that don't know, Johnny started Megaforce Records, and he signed Metallica and Raven and Anthrax back then in, like, 1983. Put Metallica in the studio to do their first album, Kill 'Em All, put us in the studio to do our first album. You know, he basically started the whole thing. Certainly on the East Coast. You had Brian Slagle with Metal Blade on the West Coast. And we met Johnny because he put on the Headbangers Ball show around Halloween. It was Halloween of 82 at a place called the St. George Theater on Staten Island. And it was Riot, Anvil, and Raven. And we couldn't believe at that time that somebody was bringing Anvil
right.
and Raven to New York, because, you know, Raven was this underground
English band, yeah.
You know, from Newcastle, England,
yeah.
new wave of British heavy metal, obscure underground kind of pre-thrash, you know, music. And we loved them, and we loved Anvil, and we loved Riot. You know, they were local New York for us. So who's putting on this show? Like, oh, my God, what unbelievable. So we got down there early, and there was already a line. You know, 1 o'clock in the afternoon, the line was already forming. And we just walked around handing out Anthrax flyers and tapes until we bumped into Johnny Z, who was also handing out flyers for other Anvil and Raven gigs he had coming up later that week. So that's how we met, and we found out he had this record store down in New Jersey called Rock and Roll Heaven, and next weekend we drove down there, and then that was it. We realized, this is the guy. We were wondering, how do we do this? How do we get out there? How do we get out of Queens? Johnny Z.
Yep.
That's the guy.
Yeah. No, he there should be a statue of him. I mean, you think about the careers he touched, the support he gave, the guidance he gave, and just, you know, that's an incredibly pivotal person in your life, Metallica. I mean, you think about these moments. Like, if you're just joining the show, the great Scotty and Anthrax, 40 years and still just hammering out great music and still, hell, man, you're just on Major Motion soundtrack. I get to the end of the movie and I'm like, holy cow, there it is. I'm listening to Lizzie Hale sing. You're playing guitar. It was just fantastic, man. Thunder Force.
Oh, and the first thing, that was a really, you know, it's weird. Quarantine and COVID has obviously been a crap show for everybody. That was just one of those nice, weird, surprise things that came across my plate that, you know, if it wasn't for the fact that I was stuck at home, it probably would have been one of those things that I wouldn't have been able to have done, because I would have been on tour or something else would have been going on that I would have had to have passed. And it was just an amazing experience to get to go in the studio with Dave Lombardo and the composer Phil Eisering, score all these scenes for the movie, and then co-write the theme song with Phil, and then I brought Corey Taylor in to write it with us as well. So, and then, you know, it's funny, we write this song for the movie Thunder Force, mm-hmm. and so then Phil, the composer, he plays it for Ben Falcone, who's the director and writer, who also the husband of Melissa McCarthy. He's the guy,
right.
You know who he is when you see him in the movies. He plays it for Ben. Ben loves the song, but he's like, hey, this is a movie about, like, two 40-year-old women superheroes, and this track is very dude-centric. Can we maybe get some female energy on it? And then Corey said, I'll text Lizzie and see if she's into it. And she wrote back immediately and said, yeah, I'm down. I would love to sing on it. So the whole thing came together really easy, and it was just a really great, great experience all around to get to be a part of.
Yeah, and she's one of them, and so I've known her since they were in an RV with their mom and dad taking them around to do shows.
Right.
And she is the same wonderful, talented, good human being, good-hearted and aware. She's just a fantastic person, man. I'm a huge fan of hers as well.
Yeah, she's great, and she rips on that song. We're actually shooting a video. We're all shooting like playthroughs individually, and it's going to get edited together, and that'll be something we'll be posting in the next couple of weeks. Just so there's something out there documenting that we actually did this. You know, it's funny. So the night that movie premieres on Netflix, and I got some people over the house and we're watching it, and the movie ends and the credits start rolling, the song kicks in, and then Netflix does that thing where next up, and it just cuts off and whatever. And we're like, what? Like, and then of course, so then I find out, you know, from the composer, he's like, yeah, it's the freaking, you know, it's just that Netflix algorithm. It immediately gets you watching something else. So yeah, you have to. So then I turned it back on, fast-forwarded through it, and then we watched the end credits just so I could hear the song over it. So yeah, a lot of people don't even probably realize that this song kicks in and that it's me and Dave and Corey and Lizzie and so if you're watching Thunder Force on Netflix, stick around for the credits.
You know what I love about, you know, I love a lot of things about you, Scott, but you really do know everything anything that involves Anthrax, involves you, anything you get to be a part of. You don't just do your thing and walk away and just live your life. Like, you really do. Like, that story there, like, I managed to catch it all. For whatever reason, it didn't turn it off on me. But you really do keep an eye on everything. And that's how you stay alive for 40 years in this business. You know, you think about the things you've seen and the high points. Sure, man. What, 5 Grammy nominations? But you also there when Cliff died, you know, I read that part in the book. I'll never forget. I didn't realize that you guys were out with him in Copenhagen, and when Cliff Burton was killed in that bus accident, the original bass player, of course, for Metallica. And, you know, everyone loved him. I was lucky enough to see Cliff at the Uptown Theater with Metallica.
Ah, the Uptown, yeah.
Yeah.
We were there. You know, we've got this like, documentary series that started on online that we started on Monday. We're basically, for our 40th, we decided, well, since we can't be out on tour right now, and we just need to somehow commemorate this, and so I had the idea, what if we just took every album and we spent a week on each record leading up to the actual anniversary, which is July 18th.
Great
idea. This past Monday, we started with Fistful of Metal, episode one. You know, it's about 10 minutes. It's part one of the Fistful of Metal record. Part two will actually be premiering today at 12 o'clock Eastern. So, you know, if you go on the Anthrax socials or my social, it's pretty easy to find it. And they'll all be on the Anthrax YouTube channel and on the Anthrax website where you can watch them in order. But so I've been telling these stories, you know, in these interviews with our director, reliving a lot of this stuff. And, I just the other day was going through the whole spreading the disease through among the living, those like between 85 and the end of 87, and, you know, I went through the Cliff story again, you know, because it's not something I want to think about all the time. I think about Cliff, but I don't necessarily think about that night and everything that happened. I mean, we weren't physically on the bus with Metallica. We had played Stockholm that night we had played Stockholm together. We were on tour together. We had finished all the UK dates. We were on Spreading the Disease. Metallica was on Master of Puppets. We had this massive European tour together, just the biggest shows we had played, you know, 5,000-7,000 people coming to these gigs. So to play the Stockholm show, and our tour manager had said that we were going to leave early that night, because usually we would hang out, watch Metallica, and then we would, like, rage after the show and then get on our buses and kind of caravan to the next gig. But our tour manager said we were going to leave early because there was maybe going to be some weather between Stockholm and Copenhagen, so they just wanted to get a jump on it. So he's like, so say your goodbyes, you know. So we were hanging with them right before they were going on stage. And we were like, yeah, but, you know, see you tomorrow. Don't have too much fun. You know, save some for tomorrow, blah, blah, blah. And we got on our bus and left and then woke up in Copenhagen, parked outside of a hotel, which was kind of weird because we didn't get hotels unless it was a day off. And then, you know, maybe there was no budget for that kind of stuff at that point. And it's early in the morning, and I walk into this hotel, and I see our tour manager talking to somebody, and you can immediately just get the vibe that something's weird. And I walked over, and you know, they told me, Mark, our tour manager, said there was an accident. Metallica's bus had an accident last night and went off the road and rolled over, and Cliff was thrown from the bus and he was killed. It's horrible. And you know, I'm just waking up, like literally, like still rubbing my eyes, and I'm hearing this, but I'm not really hearing it. And I just kind of like, what did you say? You know, and he repeats what he said, and I just looked at him and I was like, no, it didn't. Those guys are, you know, it's obviously they raged too hard last night and they're going to be late for the show or something. So they, you know, somebody sent along some crazy story to get them out of tonight's gig or so. Anything yeah. made more sense to me than what the truth was, because it seemed so unbelievable that that actually could have happened, that Cliff was dead. And then this guy that our tour manager was talking to was the promoter of the show, and he said, I'm sorry, Scott, it's true. We got news, you know, early this morning from the Swedish police about the accident, and Kirk and James will be here at the hotel in a few hours. They were all taken to a hospital to be checked out. Wise had broken a toe or something, and he was going home to be with his family because he's from Denmark, and James and Kirk were coming to the hotel, and you know, hopefully we would be able to hang out with them. And I was like, well, of course. And then, you know, it starts to sink in that moment that, wait, my friend, like this guy that I, like, actually him and Kirk were my two dudes in that band, you know, at that point in time. This dude that I had maybe on paper and hadn't known for a long time, you know, it had been like 3 years, let's say, 3.5 years, but we'd grown pretty close.
Yeah.
And in my young life at that time, at the ripe old age of 22, I hadn't really had much experience. I had a couple of grandparents pass, but when I was a little kid, I didn't really have much experience with losing people.
Cliff, no, you were... young, immortal. You're young. You're immortal. And this isn't just a celebrity, you know, accident, death, like we tend to, and the public tends to hear it. This was somebody you were in the trenches with, you were coming up with, your yeah. lives were becoming in parallel, and there's a bond there that nobody will ever understand. And it,
yeah, it was, it's still in so many ways when I, you know, anytime I talk about it or think about it, it seems so unreal to me because it was, you know, it was kind of something that there was just no touchstone for. You never heard, this was September of 86. When did you ever hear of a tour bus crashing and someone dying? Even still, all these years later, you've heard about stuff like that, but it's very rare.
Yeah.
Very few and far between that something like that happens. So it's just so unbelievable, you know, that he was taken from us in that way, you know, in that bubble of, like you just said, you know, you truly do feel like you're invulnerable when you're in on a tour. You're on a tour and you're with your crews and buses and trucks and, you know, the whole thing. It's you feel like the Justice League or the Avengers.
Sure, yeah.
And, it's still,
well,
still shocking.
Tell me this. Did Lars know that he was going to get kicked out of the band before that went into your book? Because I was reading, I'd never heard that story prior to this.
I don't know when that was, not too long ago. All of a sudden, I was all over the internet saying that with that, the story that, about that. It's such an old story and has been like around the around the block so many times. I don't want any part of it anymore.
Gotcha.
Like any time I even start talking about that, because it's not even my story. It was Dave Mustaine's story, like whatever. I don't know whose story it is, but it's not mine. Yeah. I didn't invent it.
I got you. All right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I don't even want to talk about that anymore. It's like anytime I bring that up, it's like suddenly I'm in trouble. And not with Lars.
Yeah, no, he knows.
You know, it's the freaking internet, and it's like, yeah. Scott Ian, did you hear what Scott Ian said? You know, it's like I don't want to talk about that.
Trust me, the internet. I thought it was going to make us so much smarter and see other things and interesting moments and facts, and you could travel through this world wide web, and it just made us a bunch of stupid, angry dicks.
Yeah, I mean, 50%.
Yeah.
The internet is great for a lot of stuff.
Sure.
And it's not great for a lot of stuff. Like, you know, everyone grew up somewhere, right? You grew up in a town, a city, whatever, and you know, you always kind of knew, just growing up as a kid in your neighborhood, whatever, you knew who the idiots were.
Yeah.
You knew, like, well, stay away from that guy. That guy's crazy. Or, well, stay away from that guy. He's racist. Or, you knew just locally who to stay away from, especially as, you know, as you got a little bit older, you'd hear from your parents, like, don't bother with that guy. There's something wrong with him. Well, now all of those idiots, you know, are now on the internet everywhere, and they've got this forum to espouse their insanity. And somehow there's enough people out there that are stupid enough to believe it. So,
that's it.
You know, look, I've traveled the world since 1984. I've been circling this planet. And if you want to even narrow it down, I've been around the United States probably more times than maybe other than traveling salesmen. I've been everywhere, constantly, always around the United States, and I've always been aware of, you know, there are a lot of dumb people out there, but it kind of always just stayed maybe under the radar until the internet.
Right, that's it. Well, we all knew who not to invite to the party, right? You're like, that guy's a dick, that guy's a racist, this guy's a bully, he's a jerk off. So you would just go, don't tell them the party's happening. Now they just walk through the front door with social media. Like, you know, to me, they just know, and they find their way in, and they interject themselves into somebody else's life on their social media. I'm like, what makes you, what's the difference? This is someone's living room. This is their personal thing, but yet all the rules have changed now. So I don't have any love for social media at all. Like, when this radio show ends, I'll turn it off and I'll never look at it again. It doesn't matter to me a bit. I love searching for interesting, cool things online. You know, that part of the internet is an amazing experience. You know, it's crazy. You talk about travel, Scott, and you think, dude, this is what shaped you. Like, you grew up with that punk rock, hardcore work ethic, but there's a mentality that comes with punk rock that always attracted me out to the outhouse out in Lawrence and all the bands, and seeing Rollins Band and Bad Brains and everybody. Lyrically, there was a smarter touch to that. I always felt like Anthrax had that punk rock foot. And then you add traveling to that. You see the world and that experience. You realize every kid's the same. Everybody wants to be in love, wants to have food, clean water, good streets, a strong military, wants cops to, you know, protect them. They want to be free. They want to travel freely. Everybody. But we just, people that don't travel and people that don't look around, they live in a microcosm. And it really, it is such an eye-opener to travel, to go out and see the world.
Yeah. You got to get off the block.
Yeah.
I realize that. I mean, I couldn't wait. You know, there's nothing wrong with where I grew up. It's not I love my childhood. I love Bayside, Queens. It was a great place to grow up as a kid. But at the same time, I had, you know, my dreams were bigger than never leaving Queens. Like, I wanted to see the world. All my heroes in bands, you know, you'd see pictures of the magazines going to Japan or being in different places on the planet. And it's like, God, could you imagine getting to do that and going to experience that culture and seeing how people live there, and just eating the food and meeting people. And Chuck D calls himself an earthizen, citizen. And I agree. I call myself an earthizen. I'm a citizen of this planet, because I've been lucky enough to be traveling the globe since 1984. And, you know, that's one of the things about, like, I miss, I do feel in a lot of ways, I feel landlocked, you know, since COVID. And I'm not, you know, saying this in any way, shape, or form for people that feel sorry for me. That's not where I'm coming from. But, you know, I'm used to traveling, and I definitely feel that, because I haven't really gone anywhere other than New York, and I'm actually in Florida right now visiting my dad, but I haven't been out of the States since 2019. You know, going on 2 years, that's the longest any of us in our band, like, have not been traveling around the planet. And especially when you see shows that you thought you were going to play, and then obviously they get postponed or canceled. And but I've really got that itch. Like, I can't wait to be in Europe. I can't wait to be in South America. I can't wait to be in Australia. You know, it's just...
Yeah, dude, I know, I know.
I'm used to doing this. I'm used to visiting these places and seeing my friends there and experiencing these other places. And I'm so lucky that is my life. As much as flying around the planet could be a pain in the ass sometimes, actually being places is wonderful. And yes, it is the best eye-opening experience, and I highly recommend getting out there. And as soon as we can, you know, seeing more of the planet other than your block, your city, your state, your country, you know, get out there.
Yeah, dude, I've said it better, and I could not agree more. The greatest joy in this life, it's all I've done. And I'll tell you, it's not to be cute and make it a pun, but over this last year, the anxiety I felt of losing my time, like, you know, the most precious thing you have is time. You know, to make the pun, the persistence of time, the idea that the clock is always goddamn ticking.
Yeah, time doesn't care.
No, it doesn't, man. And
time doesn't care. I was thinking about it too in the context of, like, all right, well, you know, at one point it's like, well, we're losing a few months of our, you know, touring lives, and then months turn into a year, and it looks like, I mean, realistically, it's going to be 2 years out of, let's say, the music business, out of our band's lives of being able to go out there and play shows. And, I'm not complaining. For most people on this planet, this has been a horrific experience.
Of course, man.
Like, yeah, I talked to Paul Stanley about this not too long ago, and he told me, he said, Scott, for me, this has just been an inconvenience. Like, look, I can't go play with my band. The shows are on hold. It's an inconvenience. I get to stay home with my family, which I never get to do. And I felt the same way about it. I'm like, well, this, at the same time, I'm not traveling, but guess what? Although my family usually comes with me. But, yeah, I get to be home, which is, for me, it's a new thing. But, you know, it's not even so much I'm worried about my band, but then I start worrying about bands that are older than my band. And I wonder, like, well, they just lost 2 years.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, of course.
Kiss just lost 2 years. The Stones just lost 2 years. Priest just lost 2 years. Like, I worry about what it means for bands that are even older than us. Like,
no doubt.
Time matters, you know?
It does.
It's not easy what we do. The physicality of playing in bands like we play in, it, you know, to perform on the level that and the expectation we have from ourselves to put on a show for people who would deem us worthy to take money out of, you know, hard-earned money to pay for a ticket and come see us. You know, I have an expectation of myself that I'm going to be able to give that person the best night I can. And, losing 2 years is tough.
Yeah, no, and Anthrax has always been that live band that just, from the first time I ever saw you to the last time I've seen you, it's always been, you're right, that physicality, that aggression, the everybody. It's the constant motion on stage. Nobody phones it in. Everybody in your band is on fire from the second the show starts, and that's what makes the band the band. You know, listen, I could do this all day, and I'll take up your whole goddamn morning, Scott. You know, I will. I just love having you on the show, man. You guys, you got to celebrate the 40th with everybody. Now, the best way, what is the best way, man? I mean, I know it's ScottyN.com, Anthrax, But how do they get everything? Because you got the graphic novel that just came out. You've got
it's not out yet. The graphic novel's coming soon.
Okay, I thought it was the first installment coming.
Well, the pre-order is up, but it's not actually physical. It's like being printed right now. We approved it about 2 weeks ago. So it's actually literally at the printers. So
Anthrax.com, ScottIan.com, get all your
Anthrax.com, Scott-Ian.com, but also the Anthrax Instagram, my Instagram, Charlie's Instagram, Frankie's. I mean, if you just ever check those, there's always information and links to, you know, whatever is going on. And like I said, episode 2 of the documentary series that we're doing on the band, the history of the band, will be up today at 12 noon. And if you go to the Anthrax YouTube channel, you could see episode 1, which was on Monday. Episode 2 premieres today. Episode 3 will be Friday, and that concludes Fistful of Metal Week. And then next Monday, we start on Spreading the Disease.
Excellent.
And every week, you know, so on, so on.
That's so great.
Each record until we get to the anniversary.
Wow.
And then we end with a live stream concert starting on July 16th. So, that's going to be fun. We've got a massive set that we're putting together, and it's going to be nuts.
I can't wait to see it. I can't wait to see you in person, and my best to everybody. And by the way, do find Scott Ian's Instagram. It's great. It really is great. I follow it, and you know what? It's a great way for people to get in touch with with the bands that they love so much. And you work your ass off with that Instagram, and you do give a lot of your personal life on there. And I think it's the thing we wanted most as kids, man. You wanted to know what your favorite bands were doing. You wanted to know how they lived and who were their friends and what were their weekends like. And that's one of those social media things that I do still agree with. And I go, man, that's the way you do it. The pictures are worth more than the commentary. No doubt about it.
Thank you. Yeah, it's Scott Ian Thrax. It's pretty easy to find.
All right, brother. Listen, anytime, you know, you're always welcome here, and I just thank you so much for taking time for us.
Oh, cheers, Johnny. Thank you.
Take care, man.